Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to this 10:20 session here at Spotlight Health. My name is Gretchen Alkema. I serve as Vice President of Policy and Communications for the SCAN Foundation. We're delighted to be an underwriter of this event, and you're going to have a great panel today talking about getting person-centered to get results. I'm going to hand it over to Margot Sanger-Katz from the New York Times, who's going to kick us off with a great discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is such a great turnout. We are going to talk about patient-centered healthcare, and the first thing we're going to do is talk about what that is. But I think many of you who have worked in the who've experienced the healthcare system have experienced times of great frustration where the system seems to not be communicating. You go to one doctor and they don't know what another doctor did, and if you have a lot of complicated needs, there's so much work that falls to patients to organize their records, to make sure that everyone understands what's happening. And I think there are a lot of ways in which our healthcare system is not really responsive enough to, first of all, the complexity of what patients need, but also just what their preferences are. You know, I think there's a lot of defaults, and we see, a lot of people, especially at the end of their life, end up not having their choices be honored. So, this discussion is about ways in which we can try to shape the healthcare system so that it is more responsive to patients' preferences about how they want to be cared for, and also try to take some of the friction out of all of the difficulties of having to be responsible for constantly communicating with all of your healthcare providers. So I want to introduce my panelists. We're going to have a conversation for probably about 40 minutes, and then get ready with questions, because we want to hear from you guys too. So my guests, I have Bruce Chernoff, who is the president and CEO of the SCAN Foundation, and Mark McClellan, who is newly the director of the Robert J. Margolis Center for Health Policy at Duke, but also has had a lot of service in government and at the Brookings Institution recently. So I really want to just start right from the beginning, person-centered healthcare. It's a little jargony. Bruce, can you just tell us a little bit? You guys have spent a lot of time sort of thinking about this term and what it means and why it's important. Can you define it for us?
Sure, absolutely. So let's talk about what person-centered care is and what person-centered care is not, because I think that will help frame the discussion. And I think it also represents some of the challenges of where we are today versus where we want to be tomorrow. So person-centered care begins with the assumption that we want to elicit the values and preferences of people as we build their healthcare, particularly people who have serious chronic illnesses and functional limitations, and that when we elicit those values and preferences, that they then drive a plan of care that is built around those values and preferences, that we build a team that is focused on meeting those values and preferences, that we develop measures, we create value, including economic value, around the outcomes of that care, and that where is it fundamentally different from what we're doing today? Well, person-centered care sounds great, like we would all want that for ourselves, but most of us are well most of the time. So while we would like to make sure that our needs and desires are appreciated and respected, that all sounds great. But at the end of the day, what we're talking about is a very particular population of patients. People. It's a people discussion. So this is really a population health discussion, and it is about the social determinants of older individuals who have chronic illnesses and functional limitations. So just two data points, since Mark and I at various points have been data geeks, health geeks at some point in our life, just we'll leave you with two as a way of driving the discussion. So one is 5% of Medicare beneficiaries. The top 5% drive 40% of the expenditures. So you can say we want value in health care, but generally, when you rob banks, you're there because the money's there. If we're serious about building better systems of care, we need to meet people where they are. The second data point I'll give you is that if you look at people with chronic illnesses, so what's the difference between patient and person? So as a physician, I'm really good at writing those progress notes. This 78-year-old hypertensive diabetic, COPD, or nice long chronic problem list. That's great, and chronic illness drives expenditures. But if you look at people with, say, 2, 3, 4, or 5 chronic illnesses, and then you say, okay, do they have significant functional limitations?
What is that? Give an example.
Okay, so problems bathing, problems walking, problems transferring, problems being able to prepare food for themselves, problems dressing. And this can just be a little bit of help, right? I'm not talking, you know, yes, this includes people who might have serious dementia or other problems, but just a, you know, really bad arthritis can make something super difficult. So the other data point is that at the end of the day, if you look at people with chronic medical problems and some functional needs, they're twice as much or more expensive than those with just chronic illnesses alone. So what person-centered care says is that if we can build models of care that actually encompass people's personal goals, that drive towards functional outcomes, not just medical outcomes, that we can measure and reward those outcomes, we will actually achieve the triple aim. We have the opportunity to achieve the triple aim of better care, better population outcomes, and lower costs. So that's the hypothesis.
Mark, can you talk a little bit about like what goes wrong when this doesn't happen, right? Like what are the bad outcomes that thinking more about patient-centered care is designed to avoid?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of emphasis these days on patient-centered care, on moving away from focusing on procedures and whatnot, focusing on what really matters for people. And just to put a point on this, as Bruce said, the good news is we've had a lot of biomedical progress. So everything from cures for cancer, we've got now close to 80 million cancer survivors living in the United States, substantial reductions in mortality from heart disease, substantial improvements in many other conditions. But the result of that, good news is that people are living a lot longer, but that often a part of that longer life is some period with functional impairments. And for, I don't know how many of people in this room have had to care for a parent, a loved one, someone with so the kind of conditions like Bruce was talking about, several health problems at once, maybe some frailty, you know, they're still getting along. They still have a real quality of life, but you can't do everything on your own and you need help and things go wrong. People are having to take care of some of that. So we do have some form of patient-centered care in this country now for the people like Bruce is describing with a number of impairments, living, but with some health problems at older ages. But that patient-centered care typically comes from a family member or caregiver whose job it becomes to put together all the pieces of our healthcare system. So if you're over 65 today, you do get coverage from Medicare generally, and that's going to pay when you go to the doctor or a hospital with a particular health problem. If you're low income, you get coverage for Medicaid, and that's going to pay for long-term services and supports, typically and traditionally in a nursing home. But those pieces are not very well put together for most individuals with health problems. That's why if you're dealing with a parent or loved one, and we went through this a few years ago with my grandparents, and it was pretty much on us for coordinating the getting the information to the different doctors, arranging services at home, and we were lucky enough that we had resources so that my grandparents could stay in their homes pretty much until they died, getting supportive care and having being in a familiar place, being with friends, having a quality of life that they really enjoyed. But boy, it was not easy, and there's only very limited support from all of those public programs for giving them the care that they needed. When they typically went to the doctor, they try to deal with the health problem that they presented with. So you get questions like, well, what's your diagnosis, and here's a treatment, and then they'd be kind of out the door and on to dealing with the next problem. There are different ways of doing care, though, and I think the future can be something where healthcare providers and people who probably aren't healthcare providers today, people who are working collectively to support a better life experience with functional decline over a long period of time, much more efficiently, so lower cost and with much better quality of life, could do it. There are health systems that do this now. Jeff Thompson from Gunderson's, recently retired CEO. For people like this, when people go see Jeff or see Gunderson, questions that they get asked are not what's your diagnosis, what's your health problem, but what happened to you, what can we do to help you meet your needs, what's important to you, and what are your resources that we can add on to and put together. So a lot of times people are having to do this themselves now, and I just want to emphasize that there's a very good chance that this is going to be part of of your life at some point, and certainly the part of your loved ones. I know people have had there's been a lot more public discussion in recent years about the importance of having a living will and having discussions ahead of time about what happens if you have like a major health event and are not in a position to say what your wishes really are. And you know, do you want heroic measures? Do you want supportive care? This is a bit different than that. I think for most people, as we're getting better at preventing heart attacks and helping people head off the really serious consequences and death from strokes, I mean, more people who will be living with some functional impairments and planning ahead for that. Not so much a living will, is more like a contract for living with these kinds of conditions, is something that most people haven't really engaged in. And just like you don't want to get to a point where you're having to make major decisions about life-supporting therapy after a major illness for a loved one, you want to plan for this stuff ahead of time, too. Because right now, it is still pretty much on you, except for some pockets and good programs that are starting to do things differently around the country. And the next most important thing is changing our policies, our health policies, to support care that's much more person-focused. It's not about just the episodes of illness and the acute care and the Medicaid nursing home supported care if you spend down all your resources, but it really tries to put all of this together better. Public policy is working with you as you try to manage these changes in your life that are going to happen for many of us and the people we love.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the sort of like person-centered part of it. So, you know, obviously Mark's talked a lot about the ways in which the systems for healthcare are, sometimes they're not working together the best they can. But even in situations where there is good communication or the programs are working well, are there sort of default assumptions about what people prefer, that if there's not a good system for them expressing their preferences, they're going to get something that they don't want?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I really appreciate that question. And so let's unpack what it means to be person-centered a little bit further. So the American Geriatric Society, and I would point all of you to a recent paper that they published at the end of the last year, culled through all of the peer-reviewed published data on what person-centered care means and what are the underlying characteristics of successful operating models. And they also looked at all of the gray literature. And many of the successful programs that are being operated today in the sort of most creative edges of the healthcare delivery system, which are often not in academic environments, as many of you well know. And so it's sort of the difference between person and patient-centered. Maybe that's where we should go, Margo, is that if you leave it to the medical system to talk to itself, it will do just that. It will sort of focus on the diseases and on the pills and on the technical metrics of did we check all these boxes. But honestly, and I really like where Mark took us, it's about putting quality of life and quality of health on a level playing field. So the life point, the contract for living point, is an incredibly important one. Because if left to their own devices, the medical system will focus on quality of health. And one of the challenges in person-centered care is there really aren't great metrics for saying, did I elicit your goals? Did I honor your goals? Did your goals drive the plan of care that we developed together and the team, if I'm your physician and I'm caring for, say, you or your mom, did we do that well? Did we course correct from time to time? Was there a single individual in the organization who was helping kind of coordinate the support you needed, not just the medical support, but your ability to succeed and thrive in the community and home of your choosing? Now, that could be the home where you raise your kids. It could be in a supported environment. It could be in a whole different array of places. But it's that difference, that tension that separates person-centered care from patient-centered care.
What are like some examples of goals that people might have for themselves that just like wouldn't be obvious to their healthcare providers if they weren't told or there wasn't a process for thinking about this? What's the range of preferences that people
have? So let me start with one and Mark can throw one. So I'll give you an example out of my practice life. I had an older gentleman early in my practice career who was 93 and had a very, very, very enlarged heart. And this was before he would not have been an operative candidate today. And there was nothing to offer him at that point in time, other than lots and lots of drugs to try to get him to pee out all the unnecessary fluid that he would build up. And he had very irregular heartbeats. And when those occurred, his blood pressure would drop and sometimes he would pass out. And he had one and only one goal. And so he and I had this pact. He had a daughter, a late-in-life daughter that was a surprise. And she was about to get married. And his great concern is that I do everything possible, that I work with his wife, that we make sure that he could get to that wedding. So we made every medical decision with that in mind. So are we, if we make a decision to change drugs to try to better control his arrhythmias, if we actually gave him more medication so that he wasn't quite so congested, or did we want to save that bang for right before the wedding so that he could be up and actually be able to dance and be able to, in essence, survive the day? He did that. He showed up 3 weeks later in the hospital. He was like, I'm done. And he passed away. But we, you know, and we did things. One last piece of the story and I'll quit. he had a birthday. He was Italian and he had a birthday while he was in the hospital. And so I was teaching on the wards and he happened to be on my ward service. And it was at the very end of the month. And so we took the interns and the medical students out for lunch. And we had an Italian lunch. And we came back with a little container of spaghetti, which had enough salt in it for like 15. I mean, we could have put him underwater. And so we gave him a little bit of a diuretic before we gave him the lunch, and then we gave it to him. And this was sort of in the old days when nurses still had the full kind of hat, the whole nine yards. And the charge nurse on my ward, and I was a very young attending at this point, I thought she was going to take my head off and put it on the table. Like, what are you doing? But he was so happy. And so for him and his wife to be able to have that moment, it was just before his wedding, was incredibly important. So that, I think, really gets at the challenge of quality of life versus quality of health. Is it a safety question or is it a living question? Those sorts of challenges that are played out.
I'm going to give you a couple of examples that tie in how there are some important public policy implications constraints related to this, too. One is back when I was in medical practice, so it's been a little while now, in internal medicine, I had a number of patients like the ones that Bruce was describing who were living with a number of chronic illnesses and really wanted something more than just their lab values to look good. So mm-hmm. Patients with diabetes, yeah, it's important to get the blood sugars down. But if you're in your 80s and the hemoglobin A1C is a little bit high because you're not exactly following an ADA diet perfectly, and it's not really that's not the main thing in your life. We can find ways to work with that. Probably the most common problem that I used to hear from patients in practice in this kind of setting was, I want to live at home. I want to stay connected my social networks, my friends. I want to stay engaged, but I can't do it. I'm worried I can't do it because I do have impairments. Often these are older women living alone. They say, I don't want to be a burden on my family. I don't want them to have to come over and take care of me, and I don't have the money to get the support I need to be safe at home. And what we'd often have to do for those patients was, we'd sign them up for Medicaid, and there would be Medicaid coverage for a skilled nursing facility in the area, and that'd be kind of the easiest default choice for them. Now, it started to change. There are now more home health options and a lot of places visiting nurse associations that do community-based care, but for a lot of patients, even today, they're not able to get those kinds of supports at home. And just one more example from after I left practice and was actually working in the White House. I was supposed to be doing health policy coordination. This was back in 2001, before 9/11, before they had really tight security around there. One of the first calls I got after being on the job for less than a month was from the president's chief of staff, Andy Carr, saying, Mark, there's some protests going on at the corner of 17th and Pennsylvania right outside the White House. Go fix it. It's like, well, that's not in my Secretary Card. I know we haven't spent much time together, but my portfolio is health policy, health economics, and go down there. And it turned out there was this group of protesters from an organization called ADAPT. which is, for those of you who know it, it's made up of people who have long-term disabilities and are living with them. They're typically getting their coverage through Medicaid, and they often find that, back then especially, found they were living in states where the Medicaid benefits really were tied to institutions. You know, it's a 1965 law, which has made a huge difference for millions and millions of people, but back then, you know, it was very provider-driven. You are entitled to nursing home care. You're not entitled to life support, supporting a living in the way that you'd like to live. So many of these individuals found that they could only get the financial support they needed to get by and live their lives if they did it the old-fashioned way, in institutions, without control. And basically, what they were protesting for is being able to have the Medicaid resources spent the way that they wanted to spend it. Like, look, I know what my impairments are. I know what modifications I might need in my house. I know how much assistance I might need from a home health aide. I've got a friend who can help me out as well, but they need a break from time to time for this to work. And I've worked out the math, and this is much cheaper than going into a nursing home. And not only that, I'm going to enjoy it a lot more. And not only that, there's like growing evidence that people are more socially engaged. Not only is quality of life better, but they live longer. They have healthy, better outcomes for chronic diseases. So all wins. But that's not the way policies are set up. And one of the things that came out of that meeting was, unfortunately, did succeed in breaking up the protests. But we subsequently introduced a Medicaid reform called Money Follows the Person. That for people who knew what they wanted, the job of Medicaid should be to give them some support and advice and help connect them to exactly the services that they needed, whatever they were, as long as it costs less than traditional Medicaid would have for someone with their level of functional impairment. Now, most people who are elderly and are going through this chronic process of some gradual declines, maybe some events where they go down and come back up, they don't know quite so much what they need as a lot of the people that I worked with in ADAPT. But with help, to help them, tee up the right resources, and you see there's a lot more potential for living better lives and getting more value for our public policy spending in programs like Medicare and Medicaid.
Why I really like this example, just to sort of respond for a sec, is that public policy tends to be built based on what's happened over the last 5 or 10 years and maybe an attempt to look forward, if you're lucky, 5 years. And 95% of the time, that 5-year look forward is either incorrect from its financial modeling or its clinical modeling or whatever the problem is you're trying to solve. So what I really like about the example you've given, Mark, is that so much of our public policy in this space is sort of purpose-built for 1971, in my mind. You pass Medicare, pass Medicaid, and we haven't really seen much change, save a few very specific examples. So Money Follows the Person is a really good example. On the institution of PACE programs. We have these very specific examples, and I think the challenge with person-centered care is how do we take what we know and can show works in limited ways? We were having this discussion earlier. There's the difference between unicorns and narwhals. So we all know what a unicorn is because we all grew up with them, either ourselves or in the books we read to our kids, but they just don't exist, thank you. And narwhals really exist, but none of us have ever seen.
Right, so I didn't know what a narwhal is. Okay.
A narwhal is a whale with a tusk. So to the degree you end up in one of the whaling cities like Boston that has, or a whaling museum, or Hawaii, you'll see these like single long tusks. They really exist, but most of us have never seen one. So the challenge is, how do we take what appears to be a vanishing species and make it actually kind of the standard?
So this is a great segue, because what I wanted to ask you guys about is, we've talked about how there are these barriers and how there are policy problems, but like, can you give some examples? You guys obviously have thought about this a lot. You've studied what exists out there. Like, where do we see person-centered care in the wild? What are some examples of institutions or programs or communities that are really maybe not getting it perfectly right but getting it close that we should be thinking about as models? Can you describe in really concrete ways what they do and how they work? Like maybe each of you could pick one?
Well, I mentioned Gunderson earlier. So it is a health program that takes on, instead of getting paid for specific services, they mainly get paid for everything. So they'll take on all of the expenses that might go into hospital care, chronic management, et cetera, in one payment. And what that gives this kind of organization is the ability to redirect resources. So you don't have to just depend on what Medicare has traditionally paid for, the hospital visits, or what Medicaid's traditionally paid for, the nursing home care. If there are better ways to spend the money, they have developed the skills and capacities to target that effectively. Now, in return for that, these organizations typically have to take on the kind of the full financial risk. You know, they're getting a fixed payment. There's not unlimited resources that the federal and state governments have to spend on these programs. So it's a new kind of approach for many healthcare organizations to be accountable for the overall costs and for
What are some things that they do that
So Bruce went through some of these earlier. I think one key point, and by the way, if you all are not in a system like this, these are some of the same things that it's important for families to think about if you're having to take on some of these activities yourself, is having a care manager. So one point of contact who has kind of the core responsibility for knowing what that patient needs, has some ongoing interaction with that person. What are their life goals at this point? What are we doing to support them? How are we matching or augmenting the resources that they can bring to this problem? And then behind that, a team-based approach to care, which may not involve that many physicians. Certainly does need, the chronic diseases do need management, but it's often not the main thing. Sometimes it's diet and nutrition. Sometimes it's social services. If people need to be connected to programs that can help them live at home, like Meals on Wheels or a couple of hours a day of home health assistance. So people who can help coordinate all of that. And some of these organizations are sort of more or less expanded into these kind of social support network. Jenny Chen Hansen's here from, works with SCAN now, previously led a very successful so-called PACE program at Omlok in Northern California, which really did all of this. It was healthcare, but that wasn't the main thing. It was also support for social services, integration into the Asian American community in San Francisco, which enabled people who had chronic diseases and very limited means to stay at home in the community. Jenny was telling me last night, and I didn't know this, but your parents were both part of this program, and even though they had multiple chronic illnesses in their later years, including strokes, other serious health problems, they never had to go to the hospital, and they lived out their whole lives in their community where they wanted to live. Now, those are pretty comprehensive models that require a lot of skills on the part of the healthcare organization to become a truly person-centered care organization that most of our healthcare organizations don't have today. So we're also seeing some steps in that direction with some of the primary care groups that we work with in our new program at Duke. Are what are called accountable care organizations that might just consist of a primary care practice, but they're starting to get paid differently instead of just fee for service. They have a second component of their payment that's related to keeping overall costs for their patients down while getting better results. And those organizations are getting there. They're starting to invest in case managers, these same kinds of ideas. Somebody who coordinates care for the person, some supportive programs, including social workers or people who are just from the community who can get out there and make sure that people are having their needs met. If they have chronic conditions that are likely to lead to complications, if they're not adhering to their medications or if they're not getting some of these non-medical factors addressed. And again, as Bruce said, it's usually not the medical issues that they're causing the medical problems. It's usually things like not having a stable home environment, not having enough support at home. So targeted ways of providing that extra help can bring down the healthcare costs and make these new models of care financially sustainable.
Well, building on Mark's comments, because I think they're spot on. So part of this is this notion that there is a program, that there is a team, that there is a link for care coordination, that the program is targeted. This isn't everything for everybody, that there's a subset of people who will benefit from this and where there is a return. And what I really like about Mark's comments are there are fully built examples, and actually PACE is a good sort of fully built comprehensive example, but it's one that's been sort of specific and kind of boxed in and hard to scale. And for really big organizations, and for those of you who work in some flavor of healthcare and in some place in the healthcare hierarchy, this is hard because you're talking about a big organization. It's not like I'm going to go home and say, Mark, I want to go start a PACE program in XYZ integrated system. I mean, it's hard to bolt something like that on. Not impossible, I just said hard. So many healthcare systems are actually on a journey that I think takes them to these characteristics. And so you can look at models, and I'm not favoring these, I'm using them as specific examples. So there's a program called GRACE, which is actually grew out of geriatrics, but the interesting thing about the GRACE program is it's built in a way that the coordination model could be based in a hospital, could be based in a medical group, but could be based with a community provider. And why that's really important is if you're in a medical system and you think that your care coordination is the nurse or the social worker like pulling remote controls from his or her office in the back corner behind admissions, that ain't it. There is a need to be able to go out into the community to really meet people where they are, and where people are is in their homes or their living environments or their churches or their community. Their support system is out there. It's not sort of in the walls of the hospital or in the walls of the doctor's office. So it's a really good example because it has the opportunity to be sort of site neutral. It's not biased by having to be bolted onto the healthcare delivery system. A couple of other good examples quickly. Sutter Health actually took their palliative care program, so there's lots of affinities between these programs and palliative care. Palliative care generally started out as a hospital consult service, and the more limited models still operate in that way. So I ran the Department of Health Services in Los Angeles County, and we actually put palliative care programs into our hospitals, but honestly, this was about getting people out of hospital successfully. And that's not particular, I mean, that's a good operating principle, but that's not particularly person-centered. But there are elements of palliative care that are trying to really be more community-oriented, and that means sort of pushing the discussion far upstream. So this is not a discussion purely about the toolbox of end-of-life care. Do you have an advanced directive, a durable power of health? Those things are really important, but they're tools, they're completely tactical, and everybody should do those things. But this is about sort of pushing the discussion upstream, because the last observation I'd make is that many people, to Mark's earlier point, many people will have a serious event and survive it. Many people will have more than one serious event and survive them. And so we go through, instead of having a life course where, say, in the 1960s or 1970s, when Medicare and Medicaid were built, the vast majority of people actually died of an acute event or fairly shortly thereafter. That's not true today. So the vast majority of us will live with the byproduct of serious medical problems, and we will live a life that will have serious interventions and some bouncing back up, maybe not to the exact same level. And then ultimately, most of us will have events that actually lower our level of function. So the idea is that we're pushing this discussion far upstream, and we're managing something that might be a couple of years or more in duration. But it really is about how we want to live our lives. And I think it better prepares people for programs like palliative care and hospice. I mean, one of the great problems is we get people into hospice way too late, because it's sort of sending a speeding car against a brick wall. It's like, well, you know when you hit it, but you don't really know till you're there. And I think trying to draw that discussion back and sort of focus on how we live as opposed to purely how we die makes those end-of-life discussions when we get there easier, potentially more informed, and potentially with a better support system around them.
So Mark did a great job of asking that question of how many of you are dealing with these kinds of issues or have in the past. And not everyone is working with one of these model systems, either for themselves or for a loved one. So I want to have some time for questions. But you know, I did want to ask both of you, what advice do you offer people who are having to navigate the system, either on their own behalf or on behalf of their loved ones? You know, given that we're moving in the right direction, maybe, but we're not every system is there yet. What advice, you know, would you give to people in the audience about how they can do the best job of making sure that their preferences are honored, or the preferences of the people that they love are honored, and they can get the care that they want and need?
I'll start. I think the first is there are a growing number of resources around. So most communities now have an area agency on aging or other resources for support in the community for older Americans. And while they may not be able to offer a lot of help directly for you because of all these limitations we've been talking about, they can connect you with resources in the area. So there are places to go for help. I think the SCAN Foundation and many organizations that the foundation works with are making these available as well. I think the second thing is, to the extent, you know, I wish it were easier, but if you do have a loved one in this situation, you know, it does pay off to have someone in the family who can coordinate all of this, who will keep track of medications, will keep track of medical records. It's easier than it used to be to get those in one place, and can serve some of the functions that we'd like to see in a better person-focused healthcare system. Things like coordinating care and sharing records and making transitions easier. But right now, I think it does take some effort on the part of families. The other thing I'd add is that there are more options now for getting care when you have these kinds of impairments outside of a nursing home, even at home. So digital technologies, remote monitoring, all of that's getting better. There are not, for the most part, organizations that can come in and really help you, you know, find a one-stop shop to do this. So it does take some work to line up, you know, what kind of monitoring do we need to use, what kind of home health services can be provided. I wish it were easier. And so that leads me to the second practical thing is pushing for policy change in this direction. You know, this is this comes in part under this rubric of payment and delivery reform, and we're not talking about delivery of food. It's like delivery of care. You know, what is care in our healthcare system really about? And we are in the midst, as Bruce said at the beginning, of this kind of gradual shift from paying for specific services, which was a perfectly good thing to do when there was a lot of emphasis on acute illnesses and preventing the heart attacks and preventing the infections. We're moving away from that to this much more person-centered approach where, because of genomics and big data and remote monitoring and digital health and all kinds of opportunities for personalized care, the right combination of treatments just is very, very different for different people. And a lot of those treatments are not things that are considered and that would be paid for as traditional medical care. So moving to those models is really hard because we do not have the resources for the government, federal, state, or otherwise, to pay for everything for everybody. You know, there are a lot of pushes out there. I think some of you in the audience are probably involved in them and trying to make, say, telemedicine more available. And the challenge is that most insurance companies, including Medicare, my old company, won't do it very, very broadly because they're rightly worried that if this is just attached onto a fragmented fee-for-service system, there are a lot of people who would use telemedicine. You know, it's not that unpleasant. There are a lot of companies that would be willing to provide it, but it wouldn't give you any real assurance that this care is truly going to be coordinated. You know, that gets back to that core issue we talked about of a care coordinator, a group working together to help you and your loved ones get to that better life. And that requires this shift to accountability at the person level. We're going very slowly on that. It is hard for healthcare systems to do it. I work with, as I said earlier, a lot of ACOs. I'd say about 1 in 10 is really getting this right in a financially sustainable way, you know, targeting treatments, targeting these additional services effectively, so they're continuing to break even through the savings that they're getting elsewhere in care. It's hard to do right. It requires healthcare providers to think really differently about their job. But what I'd like to see more of is like that adapt encounter I had. Is, you know, people demanding this because, yeah. I mean, it's so important for living a high-quality life. And I know there are many people here who can probably afford to do all of this for their loved ones on their own, but most Americans are not in that boat. They're in the boat where they're not getting well-coordinated care. They're ending up in a nursing home when it's avoidable. They're having premature or earlier deaths, avoidable complications. They're not staying connected with their communities. They're not having the quality of life that they could. And I really wish wish this was a bigger public policy, public driver of this issue than what we're seeing so far.
Bruce, I wanted to ask one small dimension of this question, sure. and then everyone get ready with your questions because it'll be your turn next. You mentioned that we talk a lot about living wills and advanced directives, people sort of planning for what happens when this catastrophic thing happens to someone in my family. What is the script or what is your advice for people to have these broader conversations about, you know, how do I want to manage living with some functional impairments or living with some episodic health problems? Or, you know, does the SCAN Foundation or is anyone else, is there, I know I recently went through with a family member, we went through one of these really great questionnaires about values. Is there something like that that you would recommend to people to have that conversation with their family members?
Yeah, sure. And let me just add one thing. I will answer that question. Let me add a period to Mark's sentence, because I think he said something really important that I don't want us to lose, which is it's this idea of demand. And I think sometimes in this world, I actually really like the example you gave, because I think sometimes in this world we feel a little beaten down, like how is it that change gets made? You know, how, when you look at a program that's as big and monolithic as Medicare or Medicaid, it's sort of disempowering, right? Until there's a change, until somebody shows up and says, I have this program, it's not called PACE yet, but it's going to be PACE, and it should be part of Medicare. Like, how do you stand that up? Or the ADAPT people saying, why is it we pay for nursing homes, but we won't pay for services to keep people at home? When we've demonstrated that they've met a high water level of need. So this is not an everything for everybody argument, it's not a blow the bank argument. So I want people to leave challenge that there is something that we can do. And I'll just give you the Los Angeles County example really fast. So I live in Los Angeles County. Today, in Los Angeles County, if you have a parent with needs, there's good, better, best. It may be very hard to figure out what good, better, best is, but you can be in, and let's say it's my adopted grandmother, and she's poor, and she's older, and she has needs. Well, she could be in fee-for-service Medicaid, Medi-Cal in California, and fee-for-service Medicare. Good luck with that. Two fee-for-service cards that don't talk to each other, but you're all there. And for those of you who don't know, kind of in California, there is the Medi-Cal service delivery network is a very hard thing to find. It's just because it's so under-reimbursed. So there's that. Then there are you know, what are called special needs plans for dually eligible individuals. So those. And those come in various flavors that range from good, better, to best. So, you know, back to the question, would you call those plans up and interview them? Before, you know, besides the marketing nonsense that happens during every open enrollment, really trying to understand, is there a care coordinator? Does that person ever interface with the home? How do you work with the providers I use in the community? Do you have providers in the community you work with or could help me get to? So you could be, there's a duals integration pilot in California. In Los Angeles County. There are PACE programs in Los Angeles County. So there are an array of choices. They're super hard to find. That's one of the problems. And I think one of the things we can do is demand that those choices be less opaque. There are some fabulous ACOs in Los Angeles County. And Mark's right, you know, there's sort of a tip of the spear. So there's 10% that are going to really, that are leading this change and more that will lead this change. So I just want to sort of, we can ask the healthcare system to supply better things and we can ask policymakers to drive that engine. But it helps for there to be a demand. So I just wanted to go to that point. Yeah, I think that there are resources, and I'm not here to sort of tout SCAN Foundation resources, but we have a series of 10 things, documents that we've created, as well as videos in English and in Spanish to help families begin to think about that. And they're like 10 questions you should ask your doctor. So sort of getting at how do you judge good, better, best? 10 things you should talk about in your family. And again, they're sort of the upstream kinds of discussions that we're having. For people who are more ill, there are all kinds of good and interesting tools. The Five Wishes program. Lots of things have been created that are out there that are valuable. And actually, if you go to our website, there are pointers to many of those things.
Okay. So lots of questions. Everyone, this is being recorded. So in order for you to answer a question, you just need to ask a question, you need to wait for a microphone. And I'll start right here with you in the blue.
So my name's Amy. Mark, I'm here because of David Ridley. I'm a Fuqua alum, but I'm also an Angeleno. And I've actually met with Alex at Grace. And one of the things that I've noticed when my mom died, I realized that there's plenty of courses that you can take that will talk to you about trusts and wills and estates and things like that. If you look at anything, you could look at the Learning Annex, if you're an Angelina or whatever. Whatever resources are in your community, there's nothing that teaches you about preparing for either yourself or somebody you know who is on a path. I don't care whether it's tomorrow, next year, 5 years from now. I can remember my dad, who's an accountant, pretty coherent, you know, with it, all that stuff, very organized, all that stuff, you know, typical Virgo. But he looked back at my mom, who died within a 2-month window, and he said to me afterwards, he said, there were things I wish she had signed that would have made his life easier in, right? And I had this conversation with Alex, and so my ask would be, and is that the SCAN Foundation, or there's some coordination of effort to put more programs in communities, classes, whatever, that are educating people, that people can learn about how to prepare this. We know about the baby boomer generation. We know there's going to be a huge swell of need of this. But there's a lack of resources to address the inevitable, whether it's yourself or a loved one. And so I was wondering if you mentioned some resources on your site, but I was wondering what else you knew about.
Well, let me start and answer that a couple of ways. So one of the things I particularly like about the Gunderson example, but both Mark and I think pretty highly of it, is that they were able to have a discussion that was not just about the health system, but in the community. There was a broader discussion about end of life and planning, and the health system really drove that. So I think one of the challenges is, it's all great that the SCAN Foundation has some materials, but it's like all these other materials that are visible and available somewhere, but they're not visible and available everywhere. And so what I really take from your point is that to the degree there are good materials, they need to be stood up and made visible, and to the degree that there are holes or better avenues for communicating, that those need to be built out and made available. And I think this actually gets at where sort of the delivery system can play a really important role. We have two really important projects going. We have leads here, and so some of you might want to talk to those executives who are here. So we've just started a project with the Hospital Association of Southern California that's beginning to ask the question, what does it mean to take person-centered care to scale from a hospital systems and delivery systems perspective? And Diane Stewart from the Pacific Business Group on Health that has done some really interesting work on their intensive outpatient care program, which was sort of looking at high needs people, but but with a really medical focus. And so they're sort of taking the next step, which says how do we infuse person-centered care in? So part of why I'm raising these two examples is I think one of the challenges is where is the vehicle for those communications? And I think, for me, one of the questions I would raise to both of you is a challenge for us is you guys touch doctors and nurses and patients and providers, people and families. I think that there's a real opportunity to sort of build it into the dialogue of a community. And again, I would go back to the Gunderson example because they've done that successfully.
I'm here in the front.
Alan Cockle with the Pew Trust. Not only have I seen a narwhal, I've eaten one. That's not my question.
Was it delicious?
My question is this. So we have a big quality measure enterprise now. We measure a lot of things, and typically the cardiologists will develop and own the cardiology measures and so on. But as you say, Bruce, we have very few measures that measure how well we're doing with achieving patients' goals. So to achieve the vision that you're talking about, do we need to be measuring that at the Medicare level across the system? And if so, where are those measures going to come from?
So the short, and let me start with Mark, I'd love for you to weigh in on this. So the short answer is yes. I mean, I think one of the provinces, we're both recovering physicians. I think, if you talk to most physicians, I'll just tell you they're measured to death at this point. There are too many measures. And candidly, most of those measures, with all due respect, are completely meaningless for people or patients. So at the end of the day, we have all these technical measures of quality, and I think we all want good quality healthcare for ourselves. But we sort of go in with the expectation, rightly or wrongly, that somebody's looking at this stuff, somebody's measuring this stuff. And there's been some efforts to try to make data more useful. So the STARS mechanism in Medicare, for example, is an effort. And I, you know, my challenge to the people who are here in the room who are responsible for measurement is we need, honest to gosh, we need less data and more information. So, you know, the big data opportunity is to take all these sort of nonsensical, doctor-driven data points about this or that little technical thing and to try to roll it up into some more holistic sense of quality that allows for judgment. So I think that's a challenge that's out there. But I fundamentally believe that you cannot improve what you don't measure. You don't need to measure everything that's important. I get that argument, but we need a new generation of measures. So we at the SCAN Foundation, we've been working with the Hartford Foundation, other foundations, to work with some of the major measurement organizations to try to begin to develop patient-reported outcome measures and goal attainment measures that could be used. We don't have the tools today. It doesn't exist in HEDIS. It's not going to exist in the CAHPS survey. And for those, so HEDIS is technical data quality, and CAHPS is really kind of experience and satisfaction. We're going to need to do this differently. And there are some, I know Bruce left, there's Bruce back there, has done some really important work, again, trying to draw out tools that could be used today from a policy perspective to measure quality. I think that's one of the single biggest challenges we have, because for policymakers, right, you're going to want to know that I'm actually getting value, that this isn't more care at more cost, but this is better care at same or lower cost. So the measurement question is a really substantive one.
So this is one reason why the policy change is hard, right? I mean, you'd like to really shift the Medicare resources into doctors, teams of providers, care systems that are doing more of this, but you know, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, if you can't measure it, it's awfully hard to do anything about it. Now, it doesn't mean we need to measure it perfectly. I do think there, you know, thanks to work that SCAN's supporting and others, there's some measures that could be used. This is not as easy as it might seem. Like, you know, you can't just ask a healthcare organization to say, you know, did this patient have a plan of care that focused on their life goals? You know, right. You get a checkbox and it doesn't mean anything. These are really things you need to engage the patient and the person and their caregivers directly on. So, you know, was I asked about things that matter to me? And am I getting the care that I want? You know, things along those lines. But those are hard to formulate. And so it's
hard to know also, like, who to hold accountable for,
yeah,
that, right?
But that's part of the shift, is that right now our accountability in healthcare is really about, you know, what happens for the provider, for a hospital, what happens during the hospitalization, for a doctor, what happens in the office visit. And that's this hard shift of moving from, you know, saying, you know, I did my job right, I checked all my quality measures for the right way to measure diabetes, but it still didn't get the patient, the person, what they needed. And getting to that higher level of accountability, it is hard. The other thing I'd add, though, is that I don't think these measures need to be perfect, because we can, once we start moving in this direction, and there are some successful, more successful models out there, and there will be, it's just a question of how long and how hard it's going to be to get there. I think we can depend on people to help make these choices, too. You know, back to my point about money follows the person. I mean, all that we really did, you know, we could have spent a lot of time doing quality measures for, you know, as your patient, as your Medicaid beneficiary getting the services they want. Instead of doing that, we said, look, for the beneficiaries, if you meet these criteria, you've got to be at this high level of functional impairment, and we think, you know, we know you're confident enough in making your choices, you decide where the money goes. And that made for some very fast changes in how care was delivered for those patients. So I think something here that matches some progress on quality measures, recognizing it's hard to do perfectly, with giving people better abilities to opt for these systems of care, is going to make for, you know, getting people, consumers more involved is going to make for more rapid progress too.
One last example, I mean, because I think this idea of you know, the perfect being the enemy of the good. So my favorite example is, if we could just ask three questions, and if we forced Medicare reimbursement to be tied to these three questions, and ACOs and all the other value-based purchasing models, if we turned to people and said, how confident are you that you understand your plan of care and are comfortable with it? How confident are you that if you had a problem, there is one person that you could go to who would help you? And how confident are you that you could actually get a hold of that person? I guarantee you, the way healthcare operates would change. So to the idea that we have a tendency in healthcare to make things so overcomplicated and to wait for perfection. And I do think that in the measurement space, we need to get to good much more quickly.
A gentleman in the orange here.
Bruce, we have two of your questions in our personal reported outcomes for home-based primary care and palliative care.
Will you just say who you are?
Sure, Bruce Luff, a geriatrician from Johns Hopkins. So a question for either of you. One quick comment. So probably about 2 to 4 million Medicare beneficiaries are basically homebound. And they're basically invisible to most medical systems. And so thinking about that population, most of which fall into this, I think is important. You were both talking about that, but I just wanted to call that out. The other, in terms of coming back to money following the patient, just wondering if you saw a role for, you know, lots of beds are in assisted living, right, which are really not part of the reimbursed healthcare system, which could probably be used in a much cheaper way than nursing home beds. Just a comment on that.
Yeah, I think that is where for states that have done these Medicaid reforms that give people more control over how they get their benefits, you see big shifts to assisted living, even bigger, frankly, to home-based care arrangements with home modifications, you know, home health aides, respite time for caregivers, that sort of thing. The reason that I think it hasn't happened even more is that there are some concerns among the states who are budgeting, you know, have to pay the bills for these programs that, well, if we make it too easy for people to get all of these better alternatives, then a lot more people are going to come into Medicaid, we'll have these woodwork effects, and costs will go way up. And, you know, that's not a very good justification for public policy. On the other hand, you do have to be careful about these programs. I mean, most of the long-term services and supports that are being provided today for people who have these kinds of impairments and are trying to live a good life or trying to get support for a good life are coming from from people's families, from their own financial resources, and that's a lot of resources. Another reason something to be doing now is definitely saving for retirement. I think some of the estimates are, 4 or 5 years of significant impairment, which is not that unusual. We don't have an insurance system for that for that kind of support. That you're talking really, setting aside several million dollars for you, or if you don't want to be a burden on family members at that stage. Hopefully, by then we'll have much more effective systems of care in place. But definitely we're not there yet, and hopefully the public policies will find ways to get the resources where they can make the most difference on top of what people are providing themselves.
So I think we have time for just one more question, so make it a good one. I'm just here. Yeah.
Roger Sheffield with Pine Springs Health here in Colorado. You mentioned a lot about the physical health, but you haven't incorporated the behavioral health side of this. And I'd like for you to just talk a little bit about, maybe from the scans perspective, of how you integrate person-centered in with the behavioral health side.
So super important. I really appreciate you asking the question, because I think as a panel, we sort of glossed over it, but I'm going to be shocked if Mark and I are not in the exact same place. It is fundamental to the question of person-centered care. And when you look, just if you do the green eye shade thing for a second, if you think about who is in this very high cost, high needs bracket, where a targeted program can make a tremendous amount of difference, both in somebody's lives and in the resources that we're trying to put to work here, both public and private, personal. Behavioral health is a ginormous component of that, and to ignore that is a great disservice to people and families, but you do so at your own peril if you're operating a system. So, in my simple mind, there's sort of this sort of four quadrant view of what makes up. There's a million ways to try to segment this population if we're having a population health discussion, but we're talking about people here, and people don't come in one box. So you're generally not just in the medical box or just in the behavioral health box. So for each individual and family, you're sort of left with, what are their medical conditions? What are their behavioral health needs? What are their supportive health needs? And what are their kind of environmental needs? And as you start to think about those four quadrants, you do different things for different people. And so, does behavioral health lends into homelessness, or does it lends into the medical problems? Does it? So
The person-centered care requires a holistic approach that assumes that you're asking all those questions. And again, you know, the difference between patient-centered care and person-centered care, with all due respect to the medical folks who are here, if this is a, you know, where is the variation in the model, where's the opportunity to reduce variation, the medical system just continues to focus on the diseases. And on a good day, they'll say, oh, we do a smidge of behavioral health and we do a smidge of, like, coordination at home, which is very limited. And honestly, the variation is predominantly in function and environment and the rest of behavioral health that is sort of invisible to the traditional medical system.
Every single program that I've seen that's effective at moving to this person-centered approach integrates behavioral health in a major way, not necessarily with lots of psychiatry. Sometimes it can be nurses who are specially trained, pharmacists, social workers, but very much focusing on things like the high rates of depression in this population and the very high rates of inappropriate use of medications that are designed to address behavioral issues that really have other underlying causes or could be handled through better behavioral mechanisms. So absolutely critical.
Well, I want to make sure everyone has time to get to the next panel, but thank you all so much for coming. If you have questions that you didn't have answered, come up now.